we present the news quiz with your host, Miles Jupp.
Hello, and welcome to the news quiz. We start with a cutting from The Guardian, read by Diana Speed.
The leader of a Christian group who claimed that the world would end on Wednesday has admitted that his prediction was incorrect. Chris McCann had warned that the planet would be destroyed with fire on the 7th of October. This did not happen.
Our thanks to Ryan Hockley for sending in that nonsense. Now, let's meet the teams. Will you welcome first on my right, Jeremy Hardy and senior editor at The Economist, Anne McElvoy. And opposite them on my left, Sarah Pascoe and Bob Mills. Jeremy, who thinks that consistency is surplus to requirements?
This will be John McDonnell trying to negotiate the guile and gamesmanship of the aristocracy in a bit of a haphazard fashion, because George Osborne came up with a ruse, which is this fiscal charter, which would tie the hands of the Chancellor, something he might or might not enjoy, we're not sure. But what it would mean would be that any Chancellor is forced to run a surplus in normal times. Some economists say that's rubbish. Most people say it's irrelevant and meaningless because it can be repealed or ignored, as indeed Osborne has ignored most of all of his targets, in fact, and kind of complete U-turn on deficit reduction and implemented the ice-dying plan. Anyway, point being that he set up a trap for Labour and there was no way round it, really. Either you're a deficit denier or you're austerity light. But what really Osborne was trying to do is divide Labour and also win over those Labour MPs who are rather closer to Osborne than they are to the aims and values of the Labour Party. What you see, they don't want Labour to go away, but they want Labour to be there to mind the store for when they need a break. Kind of Labour to be supply Tories for when the actual Tories, you know, are poorly or have a nervous breakdown. So that's basically what the role of the Labour Party would be in an ideal world run by Osborne and Chuckaramana, you see.
I think it's much better for politicians to change their mind based on new information that's made them think maybe they were wrong the first time than to just go, well, I've already said it, like a quiz, I've got to take your first answer. Sorry, guys.
I think it's fair enough to say that new Labour leadership had not predicted victory. I think there's a lack of preparation. There clearly wasn't a plan B. There was no contingency plan for the eventuality of Corbyn actually winning. But they're finding their way slowly, I suppose.
Call me the woman from The Economist, but not knowing within 2 weeks whether you actually want to run a budget surplus or you don't, it is a bit like turning up to the driving test without knowing where the indicator is, right? You can go one way or the other, but you can't really not know, especially as I like that Jeremy Corbyn in his conference speech said he would make a brilliant Chancellor. Which one?
Does anyone know what happened at the meeting of the Parliamentary Labour Party this week?
I imagine that they were all hateful because Corbyn, sadly, has only got about 20 people supporting him and the rest of them are all just baying for his blood and waiting for him to fail and doing everything they can to undermine him. Because the trouble is, and when I say this, I mean, we're in a new kind of period of politics without personal abuse. And I say this in the spirit of inclusivity and openness, reaching out to all sections of the Labour Party. There are some real bastards in it.
So what's happening with Jeremy, then?
Me personally, or Jeremy Corbyn?
Yeah.
Had a prostate exam recently. I think I'm getting a bit of arthritis in this hand. What else is happening?
How did it go, your prostate exam?
I passed, but thankfully not in that sense. I did mess up the reversing, though, it has to be said. I thought the marrow was a good moment because he posed with somebody's marrow, prize-winning marrow, and it was a huge tumescent, priapic thing. He looked very authoritative, and he did compare it disparagingly to David Miliband's banana, which
what
I thought was...
I went for Sunday lunch recently in the Cotswolds with some people that I really don't like very much.
Thank God this isn't going out on the radio.
Oh, you know who you are. They listen to this. Well, we went for Sunday lunch and the starter was marrow, and I like marrow. And my mum used to cook stuffed marrow, and I like marrow, and I ordered it. And do you know what it was? It wasn't marrow, it was marrow. They cook and serve you bone marrow? I was disgusted.
Well, what an emotional journey for us all. Incongruously, this is the reaction of that smoking hole in the British political landscape, the Labour Party, to the government's budget surplus plan. Indecisive Shadow Chancellor John McDonnell, or is he, changed his mind this week and voted against George Osborne's new fiscal rules. His shock U-turn took the party away from anti-austerity and then away from anti-anti-austerity. The Labour Party is now less U-turn and more panicked marital spat on an unfamiliar roundabout. George Osborne's plan for a budget surplus has been described by some as a trap for Labour. I'm not much of a huntsman myself, but as I understand it, it's not usually necessary to lay a trap for something that is already dead. Earlier in the week, there was a very angry meeting of the Parliamentary Labour Party on this issue. Moderate MP Ian Austin stood up and said Jeremy should start acting like the leader of the opposition and not like a student union president, which Corbyn swiftly rebuffed by announcing a 5 pints for a tenner deal at the bar and reminding everyone that the shop only sells fair trade, yeah? Anyway, all this seems like thoroughly sensible behaviour on the part of the Labour Party, and just the sort of thing that, come the next general election, will see Jeremy Corbyn riding victoriously into Downing Street on the back of a publicly owned unicorn. 2 points to Jeremy. Anne, who's under pressure due to the pressure they put on others to put others under pressure?
Yes. This is Mr. Tom Watson, Jeremy Corbyn's able deputy. And we thought that Tom Watson would be the enforcer and would stop the Corbyn chaos. But in fact, of course, because they're just there to prove us wrong all the time in the commentariat, he has gone and unleashed some chaos all of his own. And this was the charge that he brought up in the Commons, where you have privilege to say anything you want about anyone you don't like. And he said, well, there's this widespread paedophile ring linked to Number 10, which actually, on a slow news day, you know, you would sit up and listen to that. Anyway, there were only a couple of things wrong with that. There wasn't really a widespread paedophile ring. It wasn't linked to Number 10. And that the person that he linked it to, the late Leon Britton, who was already terminally ill at the time, has been exonerated and police are not following it up. So basically, we then ended up with a situation in which Mr. Watson was asked to apologise, which we thought that he might have done. But he said, having compared Leon Britton to as close to evil as a human being can get, he said, citing someone else, but he said it. He then said, it's not for me to judge the validity of these claims. So in the 100 years, I think, this week, since Arthur Miller was born, we've had a bit of Salem down at Westminster, I think. It was a ducking stool. And some of us are kind of hoping that Tom might be on it.
Otherwise, are you in favour of Tom Watson?
Well, actually, no, I've always... When I said he was an enforcer, he's one of those big, fat, jolly chaps. There's none of those on the panel. He's actually...
he's a very... I'm not jolly.
No, in fairness, I do think Tom Watson is...
Tom Moxon?
Tom Watson.
I don't think we should drag him into this.
No, Tom Watson, we thought, was this very efficient, quite hardline, Gordon Brown-trained thug who would come in and biff them all. So to that extent, actually, I was a bit of a Tom Watson fan. But I do think this is a case of, if in a hole, stop digging, or preferably at Westminster, push someone else into the hole.
Parliamentary privilege, I mean, it is quite tempting. I think it'd be worth becoming an MP so that you could just stand up in the Commons and say, will the Right Honourable Gentleman agree with me that Vinnie Jones wears ladies' pants? And there would be nothing that Vinnie Jones could do about it, unless he caught you in a darkened place.
What I do, if I've got a secret or I know something really good and I don't want to get in trouble for saying it, I tell my mum and then get her drunk and she tells everyone.
Suboptimally, this is the storm surrounding Deputy Labour leader Tom Watson, who this week refused to apologise for asking the police to investigate former Conservative Minister Leon Britton, saying he was far too busy preparing his lengthy and detailed apologies for Labour's performance in the 2020 general election. Essentially, the victims have had their reputations destroyed. Leon Britton's had his reputation destroyed, and now Tom Watson's had his reputation destroyed. I suppose what I'm suggesting it is, as they say on BBC Breakfast, this is a story with something for everyone. This pressure on Watson has come in the month that Rebecca Brooks is back at News Corp, but that has to be a coincidence. She strikes me as the kind of woman who is happy to let bygones be bygones. Certainly not the sort of person to seek a deadly vendetta, wreaking bloody revenge after bloody revenge until the stage is littered with corpses. We wish her well. 2 points to Anne. Bob, who's Aberdeen having a nice time?
Aberdeen's, it's the SNP conference, the Scottish National Party, Nicola Sturgeon addressing them. And it was a wonderful affair. How wouldn't it be? How wouldn't it be if you're a totalitarian state, a one-party state, basically, which is what they are. And she made some wonderful statements. Someone said, what about a referendum? And she said, now, come on, unless the opinion polls tell us that the majority of people are in favour of a referendum, I'm not going to... So, you're not going to have one until YouGov tell you you're going to win, right? And then you pile in and have one. They will have one. They'll have one within 3 years, I think, and win it. But they're also, because they have to act like any other political party, although they have literally no opposition. And so she has to make these speeches quite genuinely saying, next May, I'm going to go to the people of Scotland and ask them to elect me First Minister for the first time. I've never been elected. And in order to do this, we must approach them with humility and we must show them that we... Now, what you must do is just open some polling booths. And then you will be the next minister because there's no one else going to be on the card. Who else is going to be on the card?
I thought I might go up for it.
I think you should. Because you'd probably come second.
I hope so.
The other great thing was that she's made it clear, as all people do when they become in power, is that I'm not just representing the people who voted for me and the people who agree with me. I want to represent everyone. And the point she was making was that even people who hadn't been in favour of independence during the referendum, she still wanted them to be part of the SNP family. Unfortunately, what was tweeted was that I want no voters to vote SNP.
They've sort of reverted, because for a while I thought, well, maybe they're not this sort of blood and shortbread nationalism that they thought they were. It seemed to be more about them wanting a more left-wing, radical, nuclear-free Scotland, which they couldn't have while hitched to England. I thought, well, you know, if I lived in Scotland, I'd vote for independence, but then if I lived in America, I'd weigh 40 stone and carry an assault rifle. So it's kind of a pointless observation, and I apologise to the listeners for it. But they seem to have reverted, and everyone thought, well, when... Because what's her name? Mari Black's fantastic, who's 20 years old, and some of them are amazing. They all make it... it was a wonderful speech, inspiring speech about how a hero was Tony Benn. And I thought, they're really young, a lot of these nationalists, and they're all talking about how much they hate Westminster. You think, you don't hate it. You've tipped up there in May. You've found it's absolutely full of subsidised bars. It's been like Freshers' Week for months in there.
Well, hubristically, this is the largest ever Scottish Nationalist Party conference taking place this week in Aberdeen. I've no idea why the SNP chose Aberdeen as their conference venue, unless perhaps Alex Salmond looks more palatable when lit from above by the Aurora Borealis. This is my first opportunity to make jokes at the expense of the Scottish Nationalists, but from what I understand from the internet, they take all these things in extremely good heart. Sturgeon pledged to stand up for the forgotten and marginalised in Scottish society, namely the Labour Party. As the conference began, a YouGov poll showed that the SNP have a 30-point lead over Labour in Scotland, so there's no evidence of a Corbyn bounce, which is also the name of a popular dance craze where you jig up and down with the red flag on in the background. And the Corbyn bounce is also the name of an activity once enjoyed by Shadow International Development Secretary Diane Abbott, where you jig up and down with the red flag on in the background. 2 points to Bob. And at the end of round one, the scores are Jeremy and Anne have 4, but Sarah and Bob have 7. We start round two with a cutting from Farmers Weekly.
Up to 50,000 horses disappeared across Europe and probably ended up in our food during the horse meat scandal, a leading food safety expert has claimed. Professor Chris Elliott made the astonishing revelation at the Fighting Food Fraud Conference held at Doncaster Racecourse.
Thanks to Edward Young for sending us that. Jeremy, have a listen to this.
I think that's the ident for regional news in the northwest of Wales.
No, it's actually the national anthem of Ecuador.
Okay. Oh, I know what this is.
So, Jeremy, it was a question. And then
no, I can guess.
Can I steal? Because I think I know it as well. Does that ever happen?
No.
No.
No, that would be. Okay.
Was that really the national anthem of Ecuador?
No. Jeremy, who will no longer be met by the Met?
Julian Assange lives in the Ecuadorian embassy, which is very central, handy for the shops. However, he doesn't get out much. The reason being that he has questions to answer in Sweden. It's all a rum-do because there are very grim accusations against him. However, the Swedes did say, off you go back to England, it's fine. Then he got back here. Then they said, we need you back there. But then he was worried that he would be extradited to America because of his leaks, which can happen to any man. It's nothing to be embarrassed about, although it's generally... The Americans will put him away forever and ever and ever because he endangered the lives of agents in the field, if you believe spy movies, which aren't actually real. And he moved into this Ecuadorian embassy because they said, well, you can come and stay. It's all right. It's fine. We've got some bedding in the airing cupboard. We have to be up early, but there's some Cocoa Pops above the microwave. Help yourself. And so he lives there, and he's lived there for a very long time. But it's cost millions because loads and loads of police basically just stand there. And it's costing so much. They said they're going to scrap that and they're going to watch him covertly, which I think will be great, because then one of them will be, like, pretending to clean windows over the street. One will be selling ice creams on the corner. And then one will have one of those road menders' tents and be peering out with binoculars. Yeah, I don't know. It's some insane amount of money that the police charge for doing
it. It's £12 million.
But then I don't understand why people say, oh, it costs the police this amount of money. You think, well, why does it cost them anything? They're at work anyway. So
exactly. But the thing is, the ones who stood outside, there just must have been the most horrible shift to pull. If the Sarge just hated your guts, right, you got to watch that door. And if a strange-looking man with slightly albino hair comes out, yeah, he's not coming out. Yeah, but if he does... Yeah, but he's not going to. Yeah, but if he does... And don't think you can just have a kip and read a book in the back, because every now and again we'll sneak a blonde person past just to see if he's paying attention.
He might not still be there. He might have snuck out ages
ago.
That's
my suspicion, is that he's not even there anymore. And this isn't based on anything, but... a woman's hunch.
it sounds
very
reasonable.
I think he's nearby.
I thought you'd had surgery for that hunch.
Anne, do you think there have been any deals done behind the scenes?
Well, there's clearly some deal was done because he ordered Domino's pizza to celebrate when the police went away.
Nice.
I know. Oh, it's a bit. It wasn't very classy, was it?
No.
It wouldn't have been my choice.
What would you have had?
What will you have when you're finally released?
Oh, when I'm finally released, I would have something with kind of fine oils and chili peppers and, you know, those sort of ones with those weird things that you don't really like, but you have them on a pizza, like
so it'd still be a pizza.
Imagine if this is the week that he finally finished the tunnel. I can do what? Just out the front door, mate. Vaingloriously, these are the latest developments in the case of Julian Assange, or as fans of Benedict Cumberbatch know him, Evil Sherlock. Police will no longer keep a 24-hour watch on the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where Cumbersange has been since June 2012. But they will still try to arrest him using covert and overt tactics. Perhaps a fire drill might work. Or maybe try tempting him out of the embassy by leaving a trail of memory sticks. Sadly, I have to make jokes at his expense due to my role as a lackey of the capitalist media who uses laughter to distract the public from the machinations of globalised corporate power. Still, nice to be working. Scotland Yard said that resources are finite and there were so many different criminal and other threats to the city, which suggests that they are at least aware of Boris Johnson. Japanese schoolchildren very much the red rag to his proverbial bull. The 24-hour guard has been stepped down and will be replaced by a much cheaper option, namely a retired police horse with a machine gun. 2 points to Jeremy. Sarah, who's revealed some kind of cover-up?
This is my favourite story of the week. This is that Playboy, the soft pornographers, because of the way pornography is now so freely available on the internet, as a business move, they are covering the women up. So there'll be very sexy, very beautiful women in Playboy, but they will be wearing... bikinis and underpants. So, because I guess so much now is sharing online and people don't tend to want their work colleagues to know they just read a great article in Playboy. So it's not a feminist thing, it's just a business thing. So this is capitalism, isn't it? Isn't it, guys?
Well, I haven't seen a copy of it. I didn't know they still made Playboy, but thank you for ruining any enjoyment I might have had by introducing the word underpants.
Oh.
What's amazing is that they've said We've decided that there is so much pornography freely available now that it's become rather blasé. Mm. And I thought, it's 2015, if you only just realised there's a lot of pornography on the internet.
Nudity's got hack.
Yeah.
Anyone here who came through Oxford Circus Station, which would be a lot of...
With the models on...
I mean, this is the problem is, it's like, it's bombardment. Oh. It's bullying. Like, it's everywhere.
Do you know what she's talking about? Did you come to Oxford Circus?
OK, I counted it. I saw 106 women in their
pants. There's actually 108.
OK.
It's easy to miss the two round the corner because you need to look back. But no, it's not 108. It's the same woman.
Yeah.
In two poses. Yeah. Look at me with the bra on. Now look at me with the bra off.
Does she work for London Transport, this woman?
Has this changed the photo policy at The Economist?
Well, yeah, obviously, we're thinking about it. You know, this brand departure that Playboy has made and what that could mean for us. Because if you actually read, they're a very serious corporate announcement about this. And they said, actually, what's much more important is the quality of the articles. And people used to say that they used to put Playboy inside The Economist. But we're worried now it might be the other way around, you know. There'll be Playboy on the outside, which will have lots of charts and graphs and explanations of the deficit. And, of course, you know, we'll be light relief, so to speak. So,
if it does work with Playboy, that people, the women are wearing underwear and there's more about the articles and the women are kind of less important to it, maybe that will also happen on page three, where that the news in briefs section gets longer and longer and the woman gets kind of smaller and more in the corner until it's just a tit in the corner, like Richard Littlejohn's.
Detumescently, this is the news that Playboy will no longer carry pictures of naked women. But as one door closes, another one opens, and in a surprise move, Total Carp has announced a radical shake-up in its editorial policy. Look out next month for a particularly saucy top-down of Jeff Evans, 56, the ever-popular course angler who hails from Grantham in Lincolnshire. Playboy says it has fallen victim to the success of free online content and the success of more niche magazines such as Hot Girls, a magazine featuring women wearing as many layers as physically possible. Next month's cover girl is Carmen Electra in a cardigan and a parka. Playboy will still feature women in provocative poses, including such classics as putting their feet on train seats, parking across two spaces, and proffering an unsolicited opinion in Saudi Arabia. 2 points to Sarah. Bob, who didn't like the look of the writing on the wall?
Homeland. I've never seen Homeland. It's an American drama. I don't watch American television. There's an American drama called Homeland, and they have, part of it is they have camps, refugee camps, I suppose. And the people producing it said, you know what, we've seen some pictures of camps, and they've got lots of graffiti. I suppose it's anti-Assad graffiti, and can we get some done? And they brought in three Arabic graffiti artists, and they said, you just do sort of graffiti, Arabic graffiti, just to make it look good. And they said, oh, of course, sir, yes, we'll do that for you. That'll be our pleasure. So now, if you're watching Homeland, but you happen to have a passing knowledge of Arabic, you watch the action and think, why does it say on the wall, Homeland is racist? This is not a cereal, this is a watermelon. And my favourite, don't worry, they're only actors. And I just thought, that is genius!
I've never seen Homeland, but everyone says they get everything wrong, people are using the wrong language. They just lumped people together as kind of generically sort of that part of the world, a bit brown. But since Hurt Locker, things have improved, and Homeland has actually now reached the standard of Carry On, Follow That Camel.
Subliminally, this is the news that a group of street artists employed to paint graffiti on the set of the TV show Homeland chose to spray messages in Arabic that, when translated, read Homeland is racist. Hidden messages are nothing new. If you watch Downton Abbey, you may spot a series of subtle messages designed to rigidly reinforce the existing English class system. The makers of Homeland were disappointed to be accused of using Arabic stereotypes and said that they were keen to draw a veil over the whole thing. Before being told that was even more offensive. This sort of thing is all too common. The other day I was watching Songs of Praise and a message flashed up on the screen urging the audience to build Jerusalem in the English countryside. If that isn't an attempt to radicalise, I don't know what is. 2 points to Bob. Before we reveal the final scores, has anybody got a cutting they'd like to share? Anne?
Well, practically everyone who read it sent this in from the Daily Mail this week. London Zoo meerkat handler found guilty of glassing her monkey expert love rival colleague in the face in a row over her hunky llama keeper lover. And we've all been there.
Sarah?
This is my one. Keith Ravenscroft says, "We were recently searching for a hotel in York on booking.com. One blog about one hotel said as follows. Everything about the hotel was great, except in the morning, I was unable to get access to the wife." We've all been there.
One way to log on.
Bob.
This was a... many people sent this. It's from an unknown publication, but it's obviously a university magazine. It's sent in by lots of people. A group of disorderly students playing a raucous game of hide-and-seek in the Harris Fine Arts Centre at 11 p.m. caused a faculty member to call the university police. The police arrived, but were not able to find any of the students.
Thank you, and now let's take a look at the final score. Jeremy and Anne have 10, but this week's winners are Sarah and Bob with 11. Before we leave you, here is a cutting from the BBC website sent in by Gary McDowell.
Golfer Sang Moon Bae needed to win the 18th hole, but conceded the game following a poor chip and a missed putt. The 29-year-old will now begin 2 years of compulsory military service in South Korea.
And with that, goodbye.
Taking part in the news quiz were Jeremy Hardy, Anne McElvoy, Sarah Pascoe and Bob Mills. In the chair was Miles Jupp, and the news was read by me, Diana Speed. The chair script was written by James Kettle, Simon Littlefield and Benjamin Partridge, with additional material by Sarah Campbell and Stephen Holford. The producer was Richard Morris, and it was a BBC Radio comedy production.